Good morning, everybody. This is Lenny Lawson on this Thursday. I had a look at my Apple Watch. It actually says Thursday the 14th, and that's how I know what day it is. Tomorrow is Friday, and that means the big weekend starts for automobile sales. You know, you still hear a lot and see a lot in terms of advertising, don't you? Although about half as much as you used to. Because dealers have found in recent months, probably the last year and a half, that you really didn't have to advertise that much in order to sell all the cars that you could get. You know, when you only are getting 25, 30 cars a month, when you're used to selling 100, then there's plenty of buyers for that, and they're paying full retail or more. So, you know, it is definitely a seller's market, will continue to be for some time, and that includes used vehicles. Of course, you're a seller. I mean, if you own a used car, you maybe aren't a seller now, but you could be. All you have to do is decide to, you know, shop your vehicle around and see what it's worth. It's still worth about the same thing, well, maybe a little bit more, depending on what it is, as it was 2 years ago. Isn't that cool? That we have had virtually zero depreciation on used vehicles for that period of time. I mean, that's unprecedented. But it's a good thing for you because the new car prices have gone up so much. And, you know, a lot of the used car or new car prices have not gone up that much. It's just that the transaction prices are higher. You understand what I mean? I mean, what we used to sell for just about dealer invoice, and then you would deduct, you know, anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 in rebates and incentives. All those rebates and incentives are gone, and dealers are no longer selling vehicles for invoice. They are charging MSRP. Now, the difference between invoice and MSRP is not that much, you know, 6%, 8%, maybe, maximum 8%. So it's not like, you know, you're getting ripped off. Retail is what every Tesla is sold for. And so, you know, a lot of dealers, when they see they have an opportunity to make a little bit more money and they know that they're not going to be getting any more inventory behind that or very little, then it's really hard for them to justify discounting anything. And then, you know, when somebody brings in a trade-in, then that's another opportunity for them to, you know, get a nice trade and then turn around and sell that and make some more money. That's how we have always made the bulk of any profitability that we had was because of two departments, and it wasn't the new car department. It was the used car department and the service / parts. And that's where most of the profitability came from. You know, you got to cover your overhead first, and a typical new car dealership will cover anywhere from 60% to 80% of their overhead with service parts and if they have a body shop. So they're basically reliant on the used car department and the new car department to make up cover the rest of the overhead and then to provide a profit over and above, you know, their expenses. And that's what all businesses do, right? They're not in it for the fun of it. They're in it to make a profit for the people who own the company. You know, when you own a share of stock, like in Tesla or IBM or any company like that, you are literally an owner of that company. A lot of people don't realize that. Now, those are publicly owned companies. I knew I could get that out if I worked hard enough at it. My company, on the other hand, is privately held. Still has stock. You know, we still are a corporation. So, you know, we have stock. It's just that I own 100% of the stock. Now, if I had partners, which a lot of dealerships do have partners, I've been partners with several people before in multiple dealerships. When I was involved in, well, at one point, 6 different dealerships that I was a part owner of. And, you know, it's good. You know, it's great. It's great to have partners when things are going bad because you're not the only one that's suffering and you can strategize and find a way to make things better. When things are great, You know, you don't really want partners as much because you got to share the spoils of the greatness. But, you know, some you got to be able to do it both ways. And really good partners, there's so many. I've had some really good partnerships, and I've had some not so good ones. The really good ones was when everybody was kind of holding hands and working together, pulling, you know, like the old tug of war thing, pulling on the same side of the rope. I've had partners before where it started off that way, and then we ended up on opposite sides of the mud puddle. And, you know, occasionally they'd pull harder and we'd get really close to that mud puddle and then we'd pull back. And, you know, that's what buy-sell agreements are for. That's why you have good documentation and good contracts, agreements, I should say, between partners so that you have an out. You have a way to get out of that bad situation. I don't think anybody should be partners with somebody they don't want to be. But, you know, when your partner is a family member, or maybe your partner has the majority of the stock, then you're stuck. I mean, I would never, in a car dealership, I would never be a minority owner, meaning that I own less than 50% or 51%. You know, if you own 51% of a corporation, you know, it doesn't matter if 50 other people own the other 49%. You're calling the shots. I guess, you know, there could be a shareholder lawsuit or something like that where they could take an issue to the courts and they could cause that to, I don't know if there, as far as laws concerning corporate ownership and corporate rights of shareholders and stuff, I'm sure there's a whole body of law that covers that. All I know is that if you're going to have partners, you better choose wisely and make sure that you have kind of the same goals in mind. You know, I've also seen dealerships fall apart because of partners who started off on the right foot. That was their only game, you know, was that particular dealership. And then one of them decided to, you know, become partners with somebody else in another store and kind of alienating their original partner. And that can cause issues too when one person is going a different direction and also wants to keep a toehold in the existing company. But typically people who buy and own dealerships are I started to say they're an educated group of people. They have to have either an education, you know, good business background, or they have to have a good business background from the School of Knocks. You don't have to have a college degree. You don't have to have a high school degree, even, to be a car dealer. That's probably what you were thinking about me, third grade education. Nope, I had a little bit more than that. But, yeah, you do have to have some business acumen. You got to have capital. You can't borrow all of it. You know, to be a franchise holder as a car dealer, you do have to have, you know, a large percentage of the capital that you put into the business has to be yours. Your own. It can't be borrowed. A lot of it can be borrowed, though, because banks, you know, as long as they feel good about who the players are in the business, then they'll loan money. Sometimes they'll stretch a little bit. You know, I've had some relationships with great banks that have helped me survive. You know, when things really got tough, they didn't run. They didn't call their notes. They actually said, okay, how can we help you? How can we make this work? I won't name the banks here, but there's one specific bank in the Tri-Cities that probably if it weren't for them, I'm not sure I would still be a car dealer because they stood behind me when it got really tough. And now good times, I say that and you're saying, wait a minute, good times. I thought the economy was going to, you know what, and, you know, it was really tough to make it now. It's really been good. For the last year and a half, what's not been good is the lack of volume. What has been good is the transaction prices. Service business is really big, and so that has fed dealers for some time now. You're seeing a lot of dealerships change hands as well. You know, most recently the Gatton organization, they sold off. Of course, Mr. Gatton passed away. Wonderful man, but his company. Is now all the different dealerships are held by somebody else. And that's the way it works. You know, and those particular transactions have to be handled by through the manufacturer. Like, for example, today, if I want to say, well, I'm just going to sell my dealership. Well, you know, I could find a buyer and I could have a lawyer draw up an agreement that we both sign on. But that's just part of the story. The rest of it has to be approved by the manufacturer. If Ford and Nissan, for example, in my case, did not like the person that, or did not, maybe not like, but did not think that the person who was trying to buy my store was capable, didn't have the capital, didn't have the knowledge and experience, and, you know, maybe had a criminal background or something, you know, they can squash the deal. And they can also exercise their right of first refusal. And that's what actually happened on a couple of the Gatton stores, is the manufacturer said, nah, we don't want you to sell it to these folks. We want you to sell it to these folks. And so that's what they did. I don't know if that's public knowledge or not, but I'm not disclosing any names. But the thing about it is you know, sometimes you think that you are calling all the shots when you're only calling part of the shots. And again, that's one of the reasons why I'd prefer not to have partners. That's why we don't here at Gateway. So, you know, I am a real live for today, new car dealer. And it is with a twist. I do disclose a lot of things on my radio show that really aren't public knowledge, like a lot of what I was talking about just now. And so that may interest you, may not. I am going to talk about some other things that you may not hear from car dealers, and I'll do that right after the break. You know, there are multiple layers of management in just about any business. You know, when I go to Powell's and get my tea, the guy at the window, well, it might be the manager, might be the general manager, but more than likely, you know, somebody that's been there a while, if they're running the cash box, you know, if they hadn't been there a while, they might be in charge of French fries, or Frenchy fries, as Powell's calls them. But, you know, the same is true in a car dealership. And basically, we have multiple departments, a new car department, which requires two new car managers, or, well, typically, yeah, two, one guy to order all the cars, another guy to work the desk, and sometimes that's the same guy. The desk is actually the man. You know that when you go to a dealership and buy a car and you're talking to the salesperson just kind of disappears. Let me go talk to my manager. Well, this is the guy that he's going to talk to. So you have that in the new and used car department. In the service department, you've got typically the first person you may run into is a porter, somebody that's, you know, welcoming you to the store and asking you some initial questions and so forth as to why you're there. And then the next person will be a service advisor. So, you know, the job of the service advisor is to identify what your, well, identify you first, and then what is your complaint? What, or complaints, plural, you know, what are the things that you're wanting to get fixed? They take that information down and they put it in their system. Now, what if they misinterpret, you know, what you're saying? What if they didn't hear right? You know, you said you had a vibration and they thought that it was a noise vibration and you meant that it is a something that you feel going down the road. Then, you know, when the technician gets that ticket, he's got to guess, you know, is this a, what kind of vibration is this? When do they feel it? You know, is it at a certain speed? Is it something they feel in their seat, their hands? You know, is it something that they're hearing? You know, is it coming from the front, the rear? You know, there's just so many different things. And so when you're talking to a service advisor, it's really, it's on them to get adequate information from you. But it's also on you to make sure that they are hearing what you're saying. And the best thing that I've seen to do that is to have them repeat it back to you. So literally, when I go to a service advisor, I say, okay, these are my issues. Now, would you tell me what you wrote down there? Tell me how, you know, what your perspective is on this, and what are you going to tell the technician? Make him tell you back, and he'll just say, okay, what you told me was that your front end is vibrating at 55 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour. You can feel it in your hands, and it's shaking. Also, when you put your foot on the brake, you feel the brake pulsating when you're trying to stop. Yes, that is correct. That's exactly what I told you. Then the technician is getting the same information, has an opportunity to fix that. Because lots of times when you go to a dealership, the reason your car doesn't get fixed correctly is because of poor communication between you and the person who's writing up the repair order. You know, another thing that you want to find out is, what's it going to cost? You know, if it's under warranty, that's one thing. Under the manufacturer's warranty, watch out if you are using some type of a service contract, aftermarket, let's call it a warranty, even though it's not. You know, it's something that, that helps pay some of the expenses if you have a failure on your car after, you know, when the factory warranty, manufacturer warranty runs out. So when you leave the dealership, you need to have a clear understanding of what is what's going to be covered and what's not. Now, what if the service advisor says, well, you know, we've got to do some diagnostic work first in order to find out what the problem is, and then we will submit that to the warranty company. You know, they'll actually, sometimes they submit it online, and sometimes they actually talk to an adjuster at the warranty company and explain what's going on. And then the warranty adjuster says, no, we ain't covering that. That's not on the policy. Oh, okay. Who pays now? You do. You mean you have to? I have to pay for the diagnostic? Yes, you do. You know, clarify that. Because if you go into, let's say you bought a car in Knoxville and you bought a service contract that they sold. Well, and then you take the car to a dealership in Johnson City or Kingsport. And you say, well, I have a warranty on this. So what kind of warranty do you have? Let me see your documentation. And you show it to them and say, well, you know, this is not something that we sell, but we will file the claim with the company and see if they'll pay it. But in the meantime, folks, we have to figure out what it's doing. We have to diagnose it. If it is, if it ends up being covered by the service contract, you will not have to pay for the diagnostics, okay? But if it's not covered by the warranty company, you got to pay for the diagnostic. Now, why would you have to pay for somebody to diagnose something on your car? Well, it's because all of those people that work in a service department, not the advisors and stuff like that, the technicians are paid on a commission. In other words, they only get paid when they're turning wrenches or when they're, you know, actually diagnosing a repair. It's like when you go to the doctor's office and the doctor says, well, you look perfectly good to me. I don't see anything wrong with you. And then as you're walking out, they hand you a bill for $150. What's that for? He didn't give me any medicine or anything. He said, yeah, but you were sitting in his office. That's diagnostic time. And it's fair. It is. You just need to know what it is up front. And I think most people will understand that if the service advisor will take the time to explain it. But we have probably one of the rubs that we've run into several times recently is over an extended warranty or service contract that a customer has bought somewhere else. Now they're getting, they've moved to Greenville, for example, and they're getting their vehicle worked on at our dealership. You know, and they have this problem and they bring in and they're just assuming in their head, well, you know, I bought a service contract, I'm covered. And they're maybe not, you know, maybe not. So it's important for you to know that before you get all disappointed. Understand, you know, a lot of this is on you. You know, before I went into the dealership, I would go ahead and if I did buy a warranty, I would just go in and say, hey, I have this extended service contract / warranty. I would get it out of my glove box, my paperwork, and I would look at it, and I would read it, and I would make sure what's covered and what's not. More than likely, there's a toll-free number on there that you could call and say, yeah, I'm having this issue. I just want to make sure that it's going to be covered. If it's not covered, then, you know, what am I going to be responsible for as far as, you know, paying for it? If it's covered, you know, you're probably just responsible for whatever the deductible is. But this is a what we call a trick bag sometimes that people get into and they assume too much, meaning the consumer. I think the service advisors assume too much too. I think they think that the customer knows more than they do sometimes, and they don't fully explain what's going on. And therefore, you know, when the customer comes back to pick up their car and it's not fixed, or the service advisor calls and says, well, this is not a covered repair. Oh, yeah, right. I knew you guys were going to say that. Well, you know, maybe it's not. Probably isn't. I mean, service advisors have a lot of experience checking on these things. Now, could the diagnosis be wrong? Could the diagnosis of your problem be for a non-covered repair when, in fact, a covered repair is what's causing the problem? And that could happen. You know, I guess the major point here is good communication with service advisors back and forth, understanding what the other person is saying, repeating that, getting things in writing. Also, never, ever leave the dealership after a repair without a copy of a repair order. Even if no problem was found, if you go into a car dealership and you get service work done, and you have a problem, you think you have a problem, they check it out and they can't find any problem. Don't walk out of that dealership with a copy, without a copy of the repair order that says no problem found. And I'll tell you in a minute why you need that. Okay, so you're coming out of the dealership. You were frustrated because you knew, you thought you had a problem. You heard this noise maybe from the right rear or the right front. You got a wheel. You thought it was a wheel bearing, and they said, sorry, we can't find anything. Should you just walk out of there and shake hands and say bye? No. Get a copy of a repair order, especially if you are still under the factory warranty. Because you know what? If you go back and say, yeah, I'm back here for the second time, we don't show you being in here the first time. Yeah, I was just here a couple weeks ago. Well, doesn't say it in our system. Did you not get a repair order? You see what I'm saying? So then, you know, the Lemon Law, for example, only covers the first 12 months, 12,000 miles of a vehicle. But let's say, you've been in there four times, which would qualify for, you know, for the same problem, which would qualify under the Lemon Law. But you've only got two repair orders because the other two times they said no problem found and nobody generated an RO. Well, that'll cause you some problems because if you go to court, then you will lose. So always get a copy of that RO. You know, there's so many different things that can happen to you in life. I'm just trying to cover one aspect of your life, and that's your car life. And if I can help you avoid an issue with a very expensive part of your financial life, your car and its maintenance, then I'd love to do that. Listen, when you get a chance, tell your friends about My Car Guru, because occasionally we actually do say things on here that are beneficial, like today. Call me if you need me for some reason, 423-552-2020. That's my personal cell phone. I don't have any other cell phone. You can call me or you can text me. Sometimes texting is better if you know how to do that. If you're still using a Star Trek Motorola phone from, 1992, then you may not be able to text me. Get somebody else to do it. But thanks for listening to this edition of My Car Guru, and I will see you tomorrow.